in looking after the space that we're in, especially I'd say the center that we're in here is being attentive to looking after things. One of the trainings that Ajahn Chah emphasized for us as monastics in caring for our living space, because all of our living spaces they don't belong to us. They're not personal possessions. They're belongings of the Sangha, and we come and use them for shorter or longer periods of time, and then we go someplace else, or we or we just fall over and die, So, but the things belong to the Sangha, so you're not really it's not ours, and so that we so Ajahn Chah would always say, when you go into a place, then make sure that when you leave, it's cleaner than when you arrived. And that's a really, really nice ethos. And so that in wherever we go, make sure you're adding to it in some way in terms of just keeping it neat and clean, keeping it looking okay. Something could be maybe fixed up a little bit. Rather than just sort of, because that attitude is really, quite, that's a caring attitude, as opposed to just using a space for, and then somebody else will clean up after me. And that doesn't really, there's not much care given to that. So and that's very much a part of monastic training, and these all, even though one's doing something externally, it is creating an ethos or perspective in the mind that's very helpful, because that just that quality of caring for the details, and not in the sense of getting obsessed and obsessive, but just caring for the details, being very careful with the things and being very considerate. Those are qualities that really help in looking after our own mind, and they really help in terms of human relations. How we get along together as human beings. In the afternoons, people make a request for the Dhamma, and even though, of course, we're here and we say that people are expecting to receive teachings. Again, it's just not a rational thing. The retreat is here, but in terms of the relationship to the Dhamma, it's really important to set a relationship in the sense that these Dhamma teachings are something that I cherish, and I would like to invite a teacher to teach on the Dhamma, and that. Say as opposed to an expectation, or sort of one of us sort of getting up on our soapboxes and giving a expounding the Dhamma, whether you want it or not, it's a respectful relationship to the Dhamma. So that's helpful in the sense that one is lifting it up and acknowledging, oh, this is really important. So both for the people listening, having that making a formal invitation, and you know, and some people are, gosh, I've never done it before. Can I do it? There seems to be so many professionals here already. But it's more like, no, this is just an opportunity to learn something. It's a formal request that, and it's actually, it's from the scriptures, the verse that is, it's from the time when, the Brahma Sahampati, it's an allusion to when the Brahma Sahampati inviting the Buddha to teach in the sense, there are beings with little dust in their eyes. They will benefit from these teachings. So it's a beautiful allusion to the invitation that the Buddha received, and as an invitation to the Sangha to give teachings, because generally we're not allowed to go places where we're not invited, or to teach when we're not invited, which is great. I mean, even in the Buddha's time, the Buddha was pretty savvy in the realm of human interactions, and knowing that, there's hardly anything more irritating than somebody who wants to tell you the truth. You really need to hear this. A formal invitation. And then for the monastics or whoever is teaching, that responding an invitation is more. When there is an invitation, there is a certain responsibility to do it in a skillful way. So that when we begin teaching, rather than just okay, now I've got my chance, bang, I'm out there, the gates, and I can finally say what I want. But bringing to mind that Namo Tassa Bhagavato, that respectfully recollecting the Buddha, and that Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhasa are explicit recollections of the Buddha's wisdom, compassion, and purity. Bhagavato, the Bhagava is the blessed one, the one who brings blessings, compassionate. Arahato. Arahato literally means one who is far from defilement. And so that is alluding to the purity of the Buddha. Sammasambuddhasa is fully awakened by himself, is pointing to the Buddha's wisdom. So that's a recollection of the Buddha, bringing that to mind, so that centers oneself, and then shortkata, Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namasami. Namasami is sort of to pay homage, so that paying homage to Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. So these are ways for us to set an intention, whoever's doing the teaching, setting that intention of a respectful appreciation, recollection of what one's representing. Because it's not about me, it's not about the person, it's not about the individual who is teaching. It's more about giving the opportunity for people to share in these, the benefits that the Buddha brought into the world over 2,500 years ago. It's a that sense of, again, reverence and respect are important qualities to be internalizing, sort of at all levels of our practice. And, you know, these are forms, and, you know, as inevitably, you know, you have forms that are reminders, and sometimes you remember and sometimes you don't, but they're forms that help one to remember. And the more we're skilled at using form, then the more we benefit from it, the more we're able to learn from it. Because even the form of just sitting quietly, upright posture is a form. It's a physical form that confines one. And then we start to learn from that. We start to take an object of attention, whether it's the breath or whether it's an image of some sort. And using that form of sitting quietly, sitting still, and then training the mind with attention and investigation. Walking meditation is exactly the same thing. It's not wandering meditation, it's sort of walking meditation, where you take a path of maybe about 20 paces, 25 paces, whatever's comfortable, and then walking a bit slower than normal pace, just so that things actually slow down. And then holding one's hands, clasping one's hands in front of one, so that there is a certain physical composure, keeping the eyes downcast so one's not sort of looking around at everything around you. And then slowly walking from, say, the beginning of the path to the end of the path. And using that opportunity, that form, to be reflecting and investigating and being alert to what mental states are coming up, what habits are showing up, what skillful qualities can I be eliciting during this time. You get to the end of the path and you turn around and stop. Just stop briefly and just recheck, okay, am I present? Am I here? And reestablishing that mindfulness and clarity if necessary, or delighting in the mindfulness that's already there, and then walk back again. It's such a simple thing, and that's, you know, in reality, human life is actually pretty simple. Being able to learn from that simplicity without adding too many layers of complexity to it. Taking these forms of what we do through the day, just getting up in the morning, doing our pujas, eating the meal, similarly is a opportunity for mindfulness and reflection. It's like one of the things I found really illuminating was to not pick up any food until I've swallowed what I'm actually chewing. And you start realizing the habits that we have, just because, you know, we're chewing away, and the mind is looking, well, what am I going to get next? And it's just And it's already sort of, you know, spoons there, hands there, so we're right into that food. So just recognizing, okay, how do I slow down a bit? And because there isn't any huge rush, really. And then having that degree of mindfulness and composure. It doesn't get much more basic than eating, but when we use that form for reflection, then we start to learn a lot. So then you realize, oh yeah, this our daily life is a basis for our practice, our training, is a large component in the practice. It isn't just something really special that we do our meditation, which is our religious spiritual practice, and then we have to wait until the next opportunity of meditation before we can do any more practice, do any more study of Buddhism. As you realize, that monastic ethos is one of incorporating all the different aspects of our life into a training, into a cultivation. And some of it is just attitude as well, in the sense of, say, as a monastic, then we rely on the generosity of the lay community in order for us to be able to exist, to live. Everything that we use and rely on is a gift from others. So that our robes, our dwelling place, medicines, the food that we eat each day is freely offered. We don't go around asking for anything. But then also, say, when people show generosity, then there's a natural reciprocation that takes place in that, just like this retreat. It's freely given, and people can support it as they wish. But the reason why it exists is because people are generous, and it is able to happen, and we give our time and energy to help make it happen. The lay people, other lay people, help support that. So it's, these gifts of generosity, there's a circle of giving and of generosity that helps. There's a different feeling behind it. And they also just things like, it's at the end of the retreat, there's books are out there, and those are gifts of generosity from either people appreciate a particular teaching and they want to make it available, and so that they or their friends get together and they print up a book, and then it's made freely available, and or people make offerings that go to the publications kind of fund, and then that's used from the monastery to do more printing, making things available, so that people do have the access to the teachings, but it's all from some generosity from giving. So that And that aspect of generosity is again a really important piece of what allows us to thrive in the in our practice and in our well-being. And that's a this a sense of say when we're willing to give to something, there's a very different quality of mind than we're looking to what we can get. So that, you know, just in terms of the meditation object, when you're just paying attention to the breath, paying attention to the mind, when you set up an attitude of what can I give to this moment, you'll it's a very different result from what can I get, how can I get knowledge, how can I get jhana, I mean, how can I get my meditation together. And it ends up being an obstacle. So that laying in many, many ways, just laying this foundation of generosity. And we do it in the physical realm, paying attention to, you know, what can I help with? How can I be of service? Serves oneself well when one is able, when one's relating to the mind, because it's just a very different ethos. And these are ways that we, in terms of practice, we're highlighting, you know, what are the ways that help lead to, say, seeing dukkha more clearly, and what are the ways that lead out of dukkha. And it's back to these Four Noble Truths that, Venerable Sariputta called it, the Four Noble Truths being the elephant's footprint, of all animals in the world, their footprint will fit in an elephant's footprint. And the same, the Buddha saying, or the Sariputta said, of all the teachings that are possible or available, they can all fit in these Four Noble Truths. So that our practice is to pick up both our daily life and our internal investigations, but plugging it back into those Four Noble Truths. What are the ways that I can see that tendency to create some kind of stress, dissonance, discomfort, dis-ease, and how can I be free from that? Because it isn't just a becoming more and more erudite in how we suffer. It's about giving an insight in how we can be free from suffering, because the motivation is very strong when we see that more clearly. But you know, the goal is really the cessation of suffering, ending of suffering, freedom from suffering. And we tend to feel that we're being put upon by suffering, or we're being impinged upon by things that are unpleasant or unwanted and make us feel uncomfortable. But you know, so much of it is our attitude and how we hold things. And so this training that we do on a day-to-day basis and with the little things that we encounter through the day, we really start to shift how we hold our experience and how we hold the world around us, and realize, oh, I see the way through to a cessation of suffering. I see how, see where the problem is and what the solution is. That's we need the formal practices of meditation, of mindfulness, of investigation, but to say that monastic ethos is learning how to apply it to everything that we're doing. What comes to mind is a story that probably many people have probably heard, but some people might not have. Ajahn Sumedho tells about his own experience of training with Ajahn Chah and feeling sometimes of, oh, what's the point? Or I wish I had more time to be at my kuti by myself, not having to deal with people. And which is that's a feeling. But the bell would go in the afternoon for sweeping up, and everybody would come out to do chores and do the sweeping up. And he'd usually wait till he was pretty much couldn't wait any everybody else is already out there working, comes out kind of last. And of course, when he gets out last, then there's no decent brooms left. You know, so it's just this kind of ratty broom with a few pathetic twigs that are there, and then you're sort of scratching around after leaves, and it's hot, and he's just sort of, what's the point? We sweep these up, and then they fall down again. And Ajahn Chah just walked past him, and he sort of saw him kind of miserable and fed up, and said, "Is Wat Pa Phong suffering?" And then he walked away, and then he started thinking about that. As miserable as he was at the time, or frustrated, I said, "Really, Wat Pa Phong's not really suffering. it's not because of Wat Pa Phong. Wat Pa Phong's kind of a nice place." sort of looking at it in a different way. That's people are good, and there's all this opportunity. It's not Wat Pa Phong that's causing my suffering. It's me. To be able to turn that attention, we use these things that we do, the practices that we have, as mirrors for shining light back onto our own heart. I'll leave that there, and we can just sit a little bit longer.